This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1972, Frances Campbell was a mother of two simply looking for a part-time job when she stumbled upon what would be a groundbreaking study on early childhood education. Researchers at UNC Chapel Hill asked her to examine the effects of early education on children from poor families. They called it the Abecedarian Project. She was skeptical. Her experience as an educator and clinical psychologist suggested that when it came to IQ, it was nature over nurture. She believed it was genetics, not childcare, that dominated our early development. But she proved herself wrong. Today, many scientists consider the Abecedarian Project one of the most significant advances in what we know about early intervention for children from disadvantaged backgrounds. Not only does it improve intelligence, but it leads to better health and socioeconomic outcomes. Frances Campbell is still studying those outcomes. She's a senior scientist at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at UNC Chapel Hill, and she joins us on the program now. Frances Campbell, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Tell us more about this Abecedarian Project. It was a pilot study, right, in the 1960s at UNC. That's how it began. Am I right?
There was a pilot study that preceded it. It itself was a federally funded randomized prospective trial. And so I wouldn't call it a pilot study, no. I mean, it was designed to be the answer.
And what was the question? It was an important question in the 1960s, right?
The question was, could you prevent the development of mild mental retardation? We don't make a lot of noise about that today, but that was the question. And the study was actually funded by a federal bureau, which was examining the incidence of retardation and the causes of it. And at that time, it was known that most cases, people that ended up being defined as mildly retarded, and that was meant an IQ somewhere between 75 and 50 or something like that, they appeared to have nothing wrong with them. They looked like healthy infants. Their families weren't worried about them as they were growing up. Nobody thought there was anything special, but when they got to school, they couldn't hack it. Somebody brought in a psychologist, and they gave them a test, and mild retardation, you need special ed, sort of thing. And since nobody knew anything that caused that sort of thing, people believed that the environment had something to do with it. It had to be. And the other thing that was well known in those years was that children from poor families did a lot worse when they got to school, whether or not they got a label. They did a lot worse in school. And so poverty, somehow or another, meant that you were going to have trouble in school. And so the question was, could you prevent this retardation? And somebody did some you know what cross-sectional research is? It's when they aren't the same people, but they're this age, and then they're some more are that age, and some more are that age. Somebody went to one of the worst neighborhoods they could find in Milwaukee, and they looked for the most high-risk families, and they looked at their children. And they gave IQ tests to everybody. Older children did worse on those tests. In other words, very, very young children looked pretty okay, but the older they got, the worse they tested.
And that is kind of a tease that maybe there's something about this environment that starts you out not so good and makes things even worse as you go along.
Yeah, and so it was known as the progressive decline in intellectual development. And back then, IQ was almost deified. It was like, listen to what I said, I thought, it was like something that God gave you. And he gave some people a lot, and the other people didn't get as much, but it was just something magic inside your head, and you could, if you had a lot of it, you were wow. Well, I don't even like that word anymore, but anyway, the idea was, could you prevent that progressive decline? And there was money to study mental retardation, and so that was one of the reasons the feds put money into it.
So tell us about the design of the study. What did it do, and what was the intervention that you provided?
The reason this study was important was that war on poverty in the 1960s had decided, well, poor children can't do it in school. We'll give them a head start. We'll have head start. Head start started as a six-week summer program for four-year-old kids. And guess what? After 3 years, after they'd had that experience, you couldn't tell them they didn't look a bit different. They weren't doing a bit better than the children who hadn't had it. So Head Start didn't work. That was one of the
That was
things
the conclusion,
people
yeah.
believed. So the other question was, what if Head Start was too little and too late? What if you started with infants and you gave them the best possible environment you could from as early an age as you could? Could you prevent that progressive decline? Could you fix it so they would do better in school? Could you enhance their development? A lot of people said, no, IQ is what it is. You can't fix it with the environment. But at the Frank Porter Graham Center, we already had a super little pilot program going, which was to enhance the environment of some poor children. And there were poor children living around the, actually it was around the physical plant in Chapel Hill. And they set up a child care program in trailers. And they started out with four babies and brought them in and treated them practically like it was sterilized city, you know. But
well, what kind of treatment did they give them? What were some of the...
It was full-time child care, but it was going to be super, super educational. They were going to be brought up bilingual. They were going to hear French as much as they heard English all their lives. They were going to have Suzuki violin lessons when they got old enough. They were going to have every possible advantage in early literacy, everything in the door, chair, table, window, everything was labeled, teach your baby to read. They were going to be reading time they were two, that sort of thing. So they started with four babies and their older siblings. So they had some toddlers and some babies. That was a pilot program. A lot of people in the psychology department, which are good hard-nosed scientists, said that's not good science. Those children were not randomly assigned. You don't know, but what you got a different kind of baby to start with. And so what we had to do, what makes the Abecedarian so special, is that it is a random trial. We found children at risk. We found families at risk. We had a reason to think they're at risk, and we had a certain set of questions like how much education the parents had, all that sort of stuff. We had a high-risk index. We had a pool of people, all of whom qualified on it, and they were randomly assigned.
We'd like to your, the control group or
to the treated group. And of course, we were looking for women in the last trimester of pregnancy because we wanted infants. And so we were looking for somebody who was going to have an infant. So that's what makes it important. The criticism that it's not random, this is a different kind of animal, this is a different kind of family, you couldn't say that. Under the logic of random assignment, if you saw difference in those children down the road, you could assign it to the treatment. You could say the treatment made the difference. And that's why the study is as famous as it is yet today.
Talking to Frances Campbell today on the state of things. She is a scientist who has worked for more than 40 years on something called the Abecedarian Project. We're going to get to the executive summary of your findings in a second. But Abecedarian, what are we talking about here? What is Abecedarian?
An Abecedarian starts ABC. An Abecedarian is one who learns the alphabet. And it goes all the way back to the invention of the printing press, when suddenly everybody had the chance to have something they could read themselves. Nobody could read back then. So how do you teach reading? And there were two schools of thought. One was that you start with teaching the alphabet. And the other is you start with teaching chair. You put the word chair on a chair. You put the word saw on a saw. And that's how you learn to read words. And so that was a controversy among educators in the 1500s or whenever that was.
And luckily, now we know both are true. It depends on the child, right?
The Abecedarians were the one who argued that you had to teach the alphabet first. And so somebody came up and said, well, we're teaching the elements. We're starting with elemental things. We'll call it the Abecedarian Project.
So now you've got these randomized, it's got a randomized test. It's also a blind test, right? You've got teachers teaching, but they don't know who they're teaching or where it's going to go.
No, the teachers know.
Okay.
The teachers have to know.
They're part of the project.
Because who shouldn't have known was me.
Right.
Because what we should have done, the children in the treatment group, from they could start as early as 6 weeks. I think most of them, maybe it's around 11 weeks or something like that, the average age of entry. You don't want tiny, tiny babies in group care because of their immune systems. But anyway, they started coming to full-time child care. And we quickly found out that they couldn't get there because where the place was located was 3 miles off the main campus and not within walking distance of where most poor families lived in Chapel Hill. And so families didn't have reliable cars. They couldn't get them there, so we had to go get them.
It also included medical care, right? There was also medical care as part of it.
Well, I said in that pilot program, medicine was a big part of it.
Yeah.
So pediatricians and family nurse practitioners were right there. And the Abecedarian study said, okay, all these randomly assigned children are going to be coming into the same kind of child care program that was in the pilot program. We've collected data on what illnesses they had. We'd like to keep collecting data. So they were collecting data on these Abecedarian children right along. The doctors were on site. One of the things that they had learned in the pilot thing was most people, your kid's got a cold, don't take him to school because he'll make everybody else sick. He's already made them sick. The children shed viri more before they're symptomatic than they do afterwards, and so you don't really save the other children by isolating the sick child unless he has chicken pox or the measles.
I'm going to take a break right here. We're going to come back, find out more about the Abecedarian Project and how Frances Campbell came to be part of it more than 40 years ago in our conversation with Frances Campbell, a senior scientist at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at UNC Chapel Hill. That conversation will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today I'm talking with Frances Campbell. She is one of the original investigators for the Carolina Abecedarian Project. It's a longitudinal study on the benefits, or, well, initially the effects, but turns out to be benefits of early education for children from poor families. And we're talking about now the fact that you had created this randomized sample of kids. They were, now it's a federally funded project. So what was the program? What was the curriculum like? What was it like for those kids who were in the program?
Okay. Let's start out by clarifying a little bit what my role was. I did not work for the Frank Porter Graham Center when the Abecedarian study started. I actually tested some of the kids in the pilot program, but I was between jobs when Dr. Craig Ramey, who was a young developmental psychologist, and Dr. Joe Sparling got together. And under the direction of Dr. Jim Gallagher, who was the director of the Frank Porter Graham Center, said, okay, let's do this prospective, really randomized, tightly controlled study of enhancing the early environment, and starting with early, with infants. Well, what are you going to do with an infant? First thing you're going to do is take care of it. But Joe was a curriculum developer, and he and his colleague Isabel Lewis, who ran the best child care preschool in Chapel Hill, everybody signed up their newborn or signed for her, worked together to create actual what they call learning games. The idea being that infants don't just lie there. They are active learners from day one. And how can you enhance that and foster that learning from day one? And they had a list of goals that they had, that children would be curious and explore the environment, be free to do it. Talk was a big part of it, talk to the child from day one. Craig believed strongly in what he thought contingent learning. The baby does something and something happens, and he learns something from that. So he was really interested in early learning. So the idea was that these children were going to be, from early infancy, were going to be in full-time child care. Full-time means 5 days a week, full days, and weekends off, but year-round. It wasn't just the school year. The center was open 48 weeks a year, and that counts the holidays.
It's a pretty rich environment.
It was a very rich environment. You start with babies, and what you have with got babies, you got a bunch of cribs. And one of the things we had already learned was that cribs needed to be 36 inches apart, otherwise kids could infect each other. Those kinds of things had been learned from the active medical research, but my job was to evaluate these children. I had been working at a developmental evaluation clinic where I learned to do the Bayley, which is a test designed to look at the development of an infant. You can see what a normal two-month-old will do. Nothing much, but he's alert. He sees what he hears. He knows you're talking to him. All these sorts of things that even a baby can do. And I was to see the treated children and the controlled children equally often. And in the perfect world, I wouldn't have known. Because I did the work at the center, I did know in the early years. Later on, everything that I tell you was done blind that way. I wasn't totally blind. But I did see the infants equally often, and we did not let the teachers who were working with the infants see what I wanted them to do. We made sure they didn't, because if I wanted them to stack blocks, I didn't want the teachers to teach them to do that.
No teaching to the test.
No teaching to the test.
Not right then.
Absolutely.
So this is it's fascinating because it's a rich environment. And in some ways, even the assumptions that Dr. Ramey and others in the program made about the children being sort of dynamic learners, that was controversial at the time. I mean, the prevailing thought was that infants are empty vessels and we fill them with knowledge. We
exactly.
do a thing, they learn it. We do another thing, they learn it. This dynamic process of give and take, that's really how a child learns, that by itself was controversial.
It was very controversial. I remember as late as the middle 60s listening to a hardcore Skinnerian, if you know what that means.
I do not.
This is something happens and the bird pecks a disc and the grain falls down and everything is, if it doesn't have a consequence that you like, you don't learn it.
It's B.F. Skinner, so
B.F.
Skinnerian.
B.F. Skinner sort of thing. Hardcore Skinnerians thought everything had to be learned that way with a positive reinforcement. Such a notion that a baby gets here wired was unheard of.
Yeah.
And in graduate school, I was taught the Skinnerian approach and I believed it. After I became a parent, I stopped believing it. But
well, I want to get to the executive summary, and then we're going to come back to the consequences of this. But this rich environment for kids, which included a lot of medical care and nutrition. Initially, I think the findings are fascinating that in the first 18 months, there is a huge difference between the control group and the treated group. And then it starts to shrink over time. So give us a sketch of what you found over these years.
Okay, if you think about two lines being drawn where there's a line that's 100, and 100 is what the average person does at a given age, and it's age dependent. You don't expect a two-year-old to do what a five-year-old can do. But to get 100 on a scale test like that, he has to do what other two-year-olds can do sort of thing. So that's the kind of scale I was applying when we – as the scale I started with, I could get scores at 3 months. The children were on top of each other at 3 months. There was no difference. By the time they were 6 months, you were beginning to see a little bit of convergence. It didn't get what we call significantly different, not even quite when they were a year old. By the time they were 18 months old and a lot of language had kicked in, they were quite different. The biggest difference that we see is when they were 3 years old, where there was an 18-point difference in test performance, and that's a whole standard deviation. That's an enormous effect size. It begins to narrow a little bit, not because the ones on top, the treated kids got to 100, maybe slightly above 100, and it's pretty much stayed there along, whereas the control kids dropped at age 3, and then they began to go back up. What was happening to them? A lot of them were going to other preschools. Chapel Hill had Head Start. It had Chapel Hill Daycare Center. There were other early childhood educational opportunities out there. So the control group is not a group of children who had no exposure to the idea of a preschool of any type. They were growing up in what Craig called the natural ecology of the neighborhood. And so they're beginning to look a little better. But by the time they're 5, they are still significantly different. From 5 on, we don't get much more than like an 8 or 9 point difference. And they gradually get closer and closer together, but they were still significantly different. And that means that 99 times or 5 times out of 100, if you repeated this, you'd find the same thing. This is not a chance finding. They were still significantly different when they were all the way from age 2 on. The big thing at 3, but they stayed significantly different all the way as long as we gave them these kinds of intellectual assessment. tests. Oh,
and was this all the way through high school as well?
All the way through age 21.
Through to age 21.
But they looked significantly different when they start to school. If you want to end the early childhood program, the treated kids still had higher test performance. I'm going to call it test performance and not IQ because that's what it really is. It's you got a standard set of things to do, and this group can do it a little bit better and faster and more of it. Anyway, then we begun to look at their, just go quickly, we begun to look at their academic performance. Could they read? I'm going to skip all the way through the first 3 years and talk about the end point of treatment because some of the kids that had the 5 years got three more years. And then they had a homeschool resource teacher that worked with their classroom teacher and then worked with their homes trying to beef them up mm-hmm. when they were in primary grades. And half the control group got that, too.
Oh, all right.
So half the control group got that.
At the homeschool, okay.
Okay. At the end of 8 years, 3 years in school, what we saw was a perfect stair step for reading. 8 years read better than 5 years, read better than 3 years. And no years was on the bottom. For math, we do not see that. What we see is two low bars and two higher bars because the kids who'd had the 5 years in preschool were doing just as well in math as the ones who got the extra 3 years. And you couldn't see much difference between those that got just the 3 years and those that got nothing.
Go ahead.
So let's come forward in time. We followed them up when they were 12. Back then in Chapel Hill schools, sixth grade was the end of primary, well, elementary school, and we had what we call junior high. Mm-hmm. So at the end of elementary school, we followed them up at 12, we followed them up at 15, we followed them up at 21, we followed them up at 30. To leap way ahead, the last time we tested this test performance was they were 21 years old. And what had happened? Surely they had converged. Remember that we kids who went to a Head Start converged after 3 years in public school. You could see no effect. You get a test effect while they were in the program, but it went away.
Mm-hmm.
We still saw it at 21. I did not think we would. It's not huge. It's 4.5 points. It's there. What's happened to the trajectory is that everybody has come down a little bit. They're no longer right up there at 100.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's come down, but they are coming down in parallel. They have not come together.
So they're coming down at the same rate as the control group, right? And because they're also, you know, falling behind a little bit or losing a little something.
What happened in reading all the way through school? Everybody read a little better year to year to year. We compare 8 to 12 to 15, and then go on to 21 if you want to. Reading. They were reading at the national average, and they stayed there. If they'd had treatment, they were slightly below that, and they stayed there. If they hadn't had it, they didn't converge at all. Those lines are almost perfectly parallel.
So you get the statistical result that is significant, that shows an improvement. That's, as you said, surprised you a little bit. And again, you're talking about test scores, what we used to call IQ. But then there's the surprise, which is in some of the social outcomes, in terms of health benefits, health outcomes, the chances that you will have a college degree and other indicators of social stability. Tell us about those and even how you came to test those. Was that part of the original?
Well, once we saw a lot of things that excited us in the Amsterdam study. A, we did not see that just erosion of the test performance. We didn't see that. And so the feds kept putting money into the study. They paid for 12, they paid for 15. And we kept seeing the benefits. And so the question became, how long can you see any benefits? After all, everybody had some first 5 years. These kids went to the same schools.
Mm-hmm.
They were from the same neighborhoods. Some of them kenned each other, you know. I mean, how long can you see this? And so we even got money to look at 21. And then we got money to look at 30. And guess what? You can still see a benefit at 30. When they were 21, let's talk about high school graduation because a lot of people make something of that. We didn't see a benefit there. Slightly more of the treated kids were out of high school on time, but a lot of the control kids were out of high school too. What we saw at 21 was the greatly increased likelihood that if you'd had preschool treatment, you were in college. But if you're 21, if you went straight to college, you're not out, which is what made 30 so important. because at age 30, the treated kids were graduating from college. About a quarter of them were college graduates. Now, we're talking, we don't have very many people, so these numbers are small. Mm-hmm. But the likelihood that you would have graduated from college by age 30 is three times higher.
Three times higher with that treated group.
Is it four times higher? I'm terrible at math. Mm-hmm. It's 6% versus 24%.
Significantly higher.
Significantly higher. These are graduations from a four-year college. I'm not talking about Durham Tech. I'm talking about a university. Mm-hmm. And that is way above. I mean, and another thing that surprised me about that is you hear so much about the African-American male is the one who just is going to bomb. They're never going to make it. The females always do better. We actually don't see that in our college graduation rates.
Among the treated group?
Among the treated group. Yeah. The males are just as the 12 that are college graduates are just, 7 of them are male. Now, the ones that have gone on to do graduate work are all female, but 7 of the males graduated from college. And in the control group, we don't see that.
Health outcomes as well, which is really surprising. Talk about that.
Yes. I mean, we never could, as these children were growing up, with all this high-powered monitoring of their health, and we know a whole lot about who was sick with what during those years. And we know some things about if you had a lot of ear infections, is that going to affect your hearing, which is in turn going to affect your language? No. it's going to make you hyperactive in school. But anyway, where was I?
We're talking about the health.
We're talking about health. We couldn't compare the treated and control because the health care is not a random assignment in the sense that we could not. It's random assignment. The ones that got it were at random, but we couldn't follow the treated, the untreated kids the same way because they went all over the place.
Sure. So they might have gotten a lot of treatment. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, and you just don't know.
They just did not have a comparable. They got whatever they would have gotten, which was somebody is burning up with fever and the family rushes to the emergency room with this sick child sort of thing. There were things out there. There were pediatric clinics at the hospital, and the doctors at the center encouraged the families to enroll there and make sure their kids got their shots and all like that. But at the center, they gave them their shots, you know.
But the outcome is that they are significant, and I think
we got some money to do a look at the random assignment effect on biomarkers of health. I'm not talking about do you feel better? How many times were you in the hospital? I'm talking about what's your body telling me. I'm talking about a doctor's examination and blood work when there were 35. If you are a male and you had early treatment, you are significantly less likely to have high blood pressure. Your Framingham risk score is significantly lower. And if you do that, the sort of old-fashioned statistical way that I did it, you still see that. If you do it the highly sophisticated way that Jim Heckman in Chicago did it, you see even more than that. But if the answer is the same. The treated males are significantly less likely to have high blood pressure and other indices of cardiovascular involvement. I didn't necessarily think we'd see that at all.
Contact with the criminal justice system is reduced among those who had early childhood treatment or intervention as well.
Alas. You're coming to our our bad news, if you want to. That is very true of the other famous randomized study of early childhood is the Perry Preschool in Michigan. That's a preschool. Those kids went from 3 to 5, and they went during the school year, and they went for half days. Contrast that with what we did all day, you know, sort of thing. They got a significant reduction in delinquency and crime. It accounts for a huge cost-benefit ratio because it was just huge. Like 50% of their control group were in trouble, and 30-some percent of their treated group. 50 versus 30.
Right.
In Abecedarian, we saw 42% for the treated group and 41% for the controls. And that is based on the advice of a criminologist at the Institute of Government who said what we should look at is charges filed because anything else kind of gets lost in the vicissitudes of the system.
Right.
So charges filed is the best look at a rate of crime. So that's what we looked at. We simply don't see the crime effect.
So yours was far different than that, than the preschool.
Yeah.
The one
in Michigan. If you ask the people, how much time did you ever spend time in jail, and were you convicted of a felony and that sort of stuff? If you just ask them, it's not significant, but the treated people are a little less likely to say they got in trouble. We simply do not see a treatment-related reduction in crime for Abecedarian. That's the bad news. I wish we confirmed the Perry preschool finding, but we don't.
We're going to talk more about the findings and how you got involved in all of this when my conversation with Frances Campbell continues. She is one of the original investigators in the Abecedarian Project, and today is a senior scientist at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Frances Campbell, helped conduct a groundbreaking study on early childhood education at UNC Chapel Hill starting in the 1970s. So how did you get involved in all this? When did your interest in this kind of thing develop?
It fell in my lap. It literally fell in my lap. I went to graduate school after undergraduate school and got a degree in clinical psychology, and then I became a trailing spouse and had two children, and was very much in my years of trying to keep one hand active professionally, but really running carpools and Boy Scouts and Sunday school and all that stuff that you do when you're bringing up your two children. But I did get a part-time job at UNC Center for the Study of Disorders of Development and Learning, where I learned to do infant tests, because a lot of the children we saw there were not developing normally at all, and you had to be able to see, go as low as any test will go. And so I had learned to do that. And I was sort of in a hiatus between part-time work when I got a phone call one summer. It was from Craig Ramey. And he had called over to CDL, where I was no longer working right at the moment.
CDL is?
That's what's that Center for Division of
Developmental Learning or something?
DDDL, we called it. Okay. We called it DIDL. Anyway, he called over there to see if somebody who could do infant tests was available to collect data on his infants. As he put them in this randomized program, he needed somebody to test them and see how they were developing. Well, a good friend of mine was still working over there, and she knew that I had time to do it, and nobody over there could do it. And so she suggested my name, and I went in and talked to Craig. And as I said, he told me that he was going to do this environmental enhancement. And I said, well, I'm a little skeptical. Do you really want somebody like me to work for you? And he said he'd take the chance. And so at that point, the program was just getting geared up. They were doing teacher training. We had a whole week of workshops for the teachers of how to do learning games and how the day was going to be organized, and the medical people came in and talked about what they were going to do, and I talked a little bit about what I was going to do, but the idea was I didn't show the teachers what my assessments were like. We didn't want them to know. And the rest is history, because Craig immediately begun to involve me as if I were, and I sort of became a de facto investigator, because we begun to write papers as data begun to come out. And we begun to see, he was very eager to get the word out, and he begun to publish findings on just the first half of the children. And so I just got more and more involved in the study. I helped to write the age 12 follow-up. Craig left UNC and went to the University of Alabama halfway through age 15, and I became the principal investigator.
And this was a program that was really living from grant to grant, right? I mean, it was billed as a longitudinal study, but you never knew from him.
You never did. When he hired me, he said he had funding for 3 years, and after that, we didn't know. 3 years sounded good to me. So,
well, I want to get a little more of your personal history, too, because you talked about being a trailing spouse. That took you to New York. You had visions in New York of pursuing your academic studies. You thought you might get your Ph.D., but that you learned pretty quickly.
Well,
that wasn't going to work.
It almost didn't work. I went to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, what was then the Woman's College, WCUNC, and I majored in psychology. And psychologists can't do anything. I mean, you have to have a doctorate if you're going to be a psychologist. And so I decided that I would go to graduate school and applied to many graduate schools and got into lots of them back in the 50s. It wasn't that hard. And I came down to UNC to major in clinical psychology. I thought that that was interesting and that I had been shown how to do testing, and I thought the evaluation, I was sort of drawn to that part of it. I thought that was fun to do. And so that's what I wanted to do. So I came to UNC, and it just so happened that this fellow from Texas had also come to UNC. And so we became history at that point.
He would later become your husband.
And he was hired by Albert Coates to help revise the driver license test. And so that was one of the things he did as a graduate student, and that led him into the field of highway safety. And Cornell University in New York had this automotive crash injury research section, and they were looking for somebody with a doctorate to help with their beef up their research credentials. And so they hired him to go to New York. And we were married, and I was expecting our first child when he went up there to live in New York, and I had to stay in Chapel Hill because I didn't have my dissertation data. So I stayed in Chapel Hill and tested little sixth-grade girls for a year, almost. I just made it to New York before our daughter was born.
But after she was born, you realized that it might be that mothering in your case was kind of full-time work, especially when you came home and found.
Very full-time work. We had the second child announced his arrival shortly on the heels of the first, and that really just sort of did me in. I had my dissertation stuff. It was unanalyzed. It was in a Three Feathers whiskey box, and it was under the crib in the bedroom. And there it sat, particularly when I found out I was expecting again. And so I told a story about, I've got to get back to this. I've got to. And I went up to Columbia University on the subway one night and went to the library and started into the literature and started working and got home about late at night, and there sat all the baby food jars out on the table. Daddy was asleep. The whole kitchen was a mess, and I said, I can't do this. And so to give him credit, when his job moved us up to Western New York, where the aeronautical lab took over this crash injury thing that had been part of the medical school. It went up to Buffalo, and we went up there, and the children were a year old and two when we got there. And he said, "You are going to finish this thing. You are going to finish." And so for a year, I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, made coffee. He got up with me and drank coffee and worked on his work. The children slept, and I worked. And then I would come down to North Carolina in the summers and work with a mentor to finish up the analysis. And I did that. And so when the children were still very little, I finally graduated. I graduated. It took me 8 years to do that.
Well, you got it done, and then became part of one of the most important research studies in early childhood development that's around today.
Yes, To have just taken that little part-time job, I mean, like I said, I was still living in the station wagon. It took over my life in a lot of ways. I feel like it took me over. I didn't take it over. But particularly after Craig left and we were still seeing exciting results, I so wanted to know what was going to happen in the future. I still want to know. I'm too old to take them there, but I still want to know.
Well, all the more interesting because you were skeptical. In other words, it overturned your prejudice about what this result, what the results would be. It's interesting.
Well, if you go back and read the literature that was prevalent back in the 60s and the 70s, IQ this and IQ that, and this affects IQ and that affects IQ and on and on and on. And it was like it was this, like I say, God-given deity thing.
Yeah.
I think about test performance now. It means something, though. What those tests are designed to do is to predict sort of how quickly you catch on to things, how rare your knowledge is, and the complexity of things that you can do. It does all of that. It wouldn't work if everybody in the world knew exactly what they were going to be asked. And so you keep that sort of proprietary. But that became sort of the least of it after a while. It was that what it meant was they did better in school. They did better in school, and they continued to do better in school, and they continued all the way up. When we followed them up into adulthood, we could see benefits.
Is there anything in the research, or have you dared to speculate what it might be? I mean, obviously, this is a pretty complex arrangement, early childhood, even the interventions. How much of it just is the attention the child is getting? How much of it is the content of the curriculum? How much of it is the medical care? Have you dared to speculate what might be responsible for your results?
All of the above? I think that I like the term environmental enhancement. I think that's what happened. If you think what happens to a lot of children growing up in real poverty conditions, probably somebody is working very hard just to keep food on the table, and there may not always be food. There may not be jobs to have. A lot of these children were born into one single parent families.
Yeah.
So there's not always enough money just to meet basic expenses. And so I think that's a very stressful environment. And sometimes families get awfully large, so there's lots and lots of kids, and parents are stressed out. There's not time to spend thinking, oh, you precious little thing, I'm going to teach you the alphabet when you're a year old, which is not what you did in early childhood education either. But somebody had time to take up individually with each baby, to talk to that baby every day. One of the things I'm proud of, because I suggested it, but they probably would have done it anyway, was that these children were in group care. They weren't being breastfed. Ones at home weren't either. But I believed, I was sort of Freudian back then, I believed in a lot of cuddling and holding, and that feeding and nursing were important. And so as long as they were on the bottle, somebody held those babies when they were drinking their bottles. And I think that matters, that they had that closeness, that sense of continuity, and they knew where they were going. They had a stable environment. They knew who else was going to be there, and they knew who was going to take care of them. We didn't have a lot of turnover. And there were always things to learn. There were always, this is science, and this is the alphabet, and these are books, and this is music. And they had good diets. They had breakfast. They had lunch, and they had a nutritious snack. They were not being filled up with junk food and grape soda. They had a chance to go outside and play actively every day, weather permitting. And if they didn't, you know, we had exercises inside too, and so they had an active life. And I think all of that contributed to give them the sort of early childhood experience that the more advantaged child probably takes for granted, and his parents do too.
You know, it's interesting to think about where you can take this report as well. Again, it answers a few questions in broad strokes, important questions, and then it raises so many more. Are you aware of other research now that's based on the Abecedarian research that drills down on some of these particular questions?
Well, one thing that I think the Abecedarian findings have emphasized, and I think you can see it going back to Head Start. We started out saying, you know, Head Start failed because we now have early Head Start, and people more and more are thinking that you should have started with infants. Four was much too late. We understand the importance of the very early environment. Abecedarian wasn't the perfect design to answer the question, what if you had started with this group started as 6 weeks old, this group started at one, this group started at two. I mean, that's an interesting question. Our study won't answer that, and there's not really a whole lot out there that will, because there are other studies of a lot of child care, but not random ones like we are.
Mm-hmm.
But the importance of the very early years, I think, is now taken for granted in a way that it certainly was not. In fact, a lot of people thought we might actually harm these children that was one of the fears. I mean, after all, taking a baby away from its mother, you don't want to do that. Well, you don't.
Well,
but you didn't in the sense. Right. They went home every night. They knew who mother was. But what about their social development? Maybe they would not, growing up in groups, they might fight more. They might be more aggressive. We don't see a lot of evidence of that. We certainly don't see any reason to think that these children's relationship to their parents were harmed in any way.
It does raise the question about whether it would be best to, in other words, a conclusion might be that this is a great model, let's replicate it, or the other possibility is that we help parents and help families provide this kind of thing in the home. Is that reasonable? Is that something that, do you think, a conclusion that your study points to or not?
I don't think our study directly points there. If I had to sum it up in one sentence, I would say if you want a child to learn something, teach him that. Don't teach his mother that. Teach him that. That's something that I would say. Now, a lot of people are going to fight me on that. And there's another huge study out there. It's called the Nurse Visitation Program. It's nationwide. They started with all pregnant, high-risk people, and a nurse visited them while they were pregnant, worked with them through the pregnancy, and then continued to do home visits. They do not see the kind of intellectual boost that we got with Abbasterian. What they do see is a reduction in child abuse and accidents and things like that. So it's a very worthwhile program, and it doesn't begin to cost what Abbasterian costs.
Do you think your research points to more active government funding for preschools?
I definitely think that. There's one thing that we didn't talk about at all, which is the follow-on study to Abbasterian, which was called Project CARE. And in that, they really tried to test whether or not you could send the same kind of curriculum that the kids were getting in the child care center, send it home to kids that don't come to a center, but let mom do it. And how well would that work? And for that study, the kids who, we still had some who came to a center and their teacher went home and taught mom, and some had mom only, and some were in a control group. Bottom line, center plus mom outdid everybody. The control group outdid the one with mom alone. Mom alone was the bottom of the barrel. And so this is controversial, but I would not argue for putting money into home visiting programs. I think parents ought to know what they're doing. I really believe that people shouldn't just have babies and have lots and lots of babies when they don't have any way to take care of them and don't have two parents to be there to help each other. That's not what I'm saying, but I think women need to learn how to take care of children.
I'll tell you what, you have just opened up the grist for a whole new show, and we're going to end this one right here, and thank you for being on the program. Frances Campbell, Senior Scientist of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, thank you so much for being on the program, and thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.